Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table. We discuss issues of God and culture. I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. And today our topic is infertility. And I have to tell you, when I became executive director at the center, I never conceived of doing a podcast on this topic. So I'll have to tell you the story why. But first, let me introduce our guests. To my left is Sandra Glahn, who I know as Sandy, so that's probably what I'm going to call her, Associate Professor of Media Arts and Worship here at Dallas Seminary. And how long have you been teaching here now,
Sandy? Teaching for 19 years.
19 years, okay. And then Julie Shannon Fuller, who writes a blog about all kinds of issues. And what else are you engaged in? You went to seminary here, didn't you?
I'm currently enrolled, okay. And just turned in my dissertation last week.
Okay.
So I will be graduating in May.
Very good. So this dissertation on?
Infertility and childlessness.
There we go. All right. Well, let me tell the story about how this happened. A few years ago when we were first doing the podcast, Sandy got up and did a chapel on this topic, and you know, it's one of those things for guys. You know, it's not something we think too much about, perhaps unless we're married and in the situation. And so, I made a mental note saying, "Well, this is interesting, and this is a common issue." And then we met with a group of under 30 millennials. In the fall last year, and we were talking to them about all kinds of issues. And in the midst of that conversation, I asked them, what podcast would you like for us to do? Mm-hmm. And without hesitation, infertility came up, and then the second one was, you know, why should we come to church? And I thought, well, that's an interesting mix. and so,
connected.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll talk about that another time. That other one's also going to come down the road, I think. But anyway, and so we decided, well, you know, that was kind of a check the box the second time. So, yeah. So I've asked y'all to come in and discuss this with us. And Julie, I'm going to let you start. How did this issue become a key for you? Just a short version now, and then we'll go into more detail later, and I'm going to ask Sandy the same thing.
Okay. Well, I was single most of my adult life and got married at age 38.
Okay.
And we waited. Everyone said, oh, wait a little while to start trying to get pregnant. You want time together in your marriage. And we waited about a year. And then we started trying, and due to my age and everything else, it took another year for me to get pregnant, and I just immediately had miscarried. And so that experience, I ended up, we went through about 7 years of that active infertility season, and then with three miscarriages. And so I worked through a lot of the pain and that burden and that questioning God, and then he's taken me down a path of wanting to kind of use that in ministry to help women and couples and young women have a better understanding.
Yeah, and actually, there are actually two parts to this conversation in some ways. It's just experiencing a miscarriage in and of itself, which is traumatic enough, and many women go through that. And then the whole infertility thing, which is a smaller group, but in some ways also much more, I'll describe it as a gnawing experience in one way. And so, okay, and Sandy, how about you?
So I'm the fourth of five kids. Okay. Imagined a big family. That's what I thought I was going to marry a pastor and have lots of kids. And when that didn't happen and we hit the brick wall of infertility, it was really a moral, ethical, medical, financial crisis. But it was mostly for me a crisis of womanhood. What does it look like to be a Christian wife? And so I started doing I was a freelance writer, and I started doing some writing. I was part of a consumer group for infertility patients. And then I started taking some classes here just to get theology. And so book number one ended up coming out of a class that I took here in writing, but I was writing about my infertility experience. And that was When Empty Arms Become a Heavy Burden, was looking at the emotional and spiritual side. Then as I was working on my actual academic work here, book two was really looking at all the different narratives that had infertility in them, and how we've taken them out and made them sort of assuming that Bible's an unabridged text on infertility, mm-hmm. instead of seeing how each of those stories function in its own narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's been a personal journey of 10 years of, 3 years of no success, 7 pregnancy losses, 3 failed adoptions before we finally had a successful adoption.
Mm-hmm.
But also sort of a professional journey, because I never saw myself as having a career, and the Lord kept opening the doors here,
right.
Closing the doors to motherhood and opening the doors to other things.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I imagine that story is not unusual, that, if I can say it this way, you kind of stumble into infertility as opposed mm-hmm. to having the expectation. I want to start there. Let's talk about expectations a little bit, and I guess my question may or may not seem odd, but I'll throw it out there anyway, because I can trust you gals. And that is, how do our expectations perhaps set us up for more pain? And what can we do to help help that tension?
That's a great question. My expectations set me up greatly, because my whole life, my dad was one of 9, mm-hmm. and I love that family. And I grew up just thinking, I was an aunt at mm-hmm. age 11,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, I'll be a mom.
Yeah, around kids all the time.
Around kids all the time.
Yeah.
And godchildren and all of that. And even through my single years, when I remember my dad kind of sadly shaking his head one day, and I said, what's wrong? And he goes, I just wish you'd get married and have kids.
Hmm.
You know, he meant it from a really great place.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was probably in my early 30s and just sitting there, well, Dad, it'd be nice to have the guy first. You know?
There is a prereq here.
You know, that's a little important mm-hmm. detail. And so I think I just assumed.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed, because I think in our world, in the Western culture, we make, my opinion only, we make family in suburban America, it is the be-all, is the end-all.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we help people understand completely who they are in Christ and what their identity is apart from those labels, those roles in life. I mean, we do it mm-hmm. with jobs. We do it with material goods.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for some women, not all women, but probably the majority, that's what we do. We have, would you say that? We have that expectation.
My husband and I would go to parties, and people would ask him what he does, and mm-hmm. they would ask me
yes.
how many kids I had.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you think about growing up, people didn't say to me, if you get married and have kids.
Uh-huh.
It was when you get married and have kids.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And because I'm the 4th of 5, people are teasing my parents constantly about, you know how you can prevent that.
Yeah.
So in my mind, the problem is uh-huh. having too many.
Uh-huh.
It never even entered my mind that the opposite would happen.
Right, right.
And so some of it is, there's social pressure. There's certainly, because the church values motherhood, rightfully so,
mm-hmm.
There tends to be an overvaluing of mm-hmm. that, to where you hear messages like, mm-hmm. You know, the most important thing a woman can do is be a mother,
mm-hmm.
or the highest calling
mm-hmm.
of a woman is a mother. That's just not true. The highest mm-hmm. calling is to follow Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And in God's varied pattern book, you know, you've got Aquilas and Priscillas where their kids aren't mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You have singles, you know, I think of Lazarus's sisters,
mm-hmm.
You know, Mary.
Deborah.
And there are lots mm-hmm. of single people in the Bible, but I think since the Reformation, right, we sort of
right.
emptied the monasteries of singles and kind of went the other extreme, and
yeah.
marriage is the be-all end-all. I think yeah. we're coming back a little bit, you know, re-looking at some of that. But some of that, those messages, you know, 20 years ago when we were really being formed, 30 years ago, it was even much more social
stronger.
Pressure.
Yeah. yeah. And so you create this expectation of what kind of the perfect life would be for the average woman in the church. I actually think that we don't do enough. I'll be interested, actually, in your opinion on this. We don't do enough to help young women think through where they are in Christ. I think the path is much easier for a man than it is for a woman in the church, if I can say it that way. And even though what would be taught actually to a man and a woman in some ways would be very, very similar in terms of your walk with Christ and discipleship. Mm-hmm. We have a wider path in some ways for the things we talk about with men than mm-hmm. with women. So I'd like to probe that a little bit. If you were if you were able to design and help pastors think through how they address their young women, and for that matter, the ministers to women that churches now often have, what kinds of themes would you think would be important?
This is a can of worms. Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Well, I think here's my take on a lot of churches and a lot of evangelical Christian churches. Mm. Traditionally, women they come in, they teach kids, they might teach other women, and I think that's been a long history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that it's a bad one,
mm-hmm.
but I know from younger friends, they can go out in the world and do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
They're really now in the corporate world.
Right.
There are less... When you say there are
less... You're
not
constantly thinking through the grid of I'm a woman.
Right.
Yes.
I'm just a person with skills that I'm bringing to the job.
And
much more
in
so
church.
In the church, you're thinking that way.
Yeah.
And so in the church, they walk through the doors, and women are telling women. In my dissertation, mm-hmm. I talk about one of the women I interviewed and how she couldn't have kids, and she was trying to find some meaning and purpose and went to a church and offered to help out in the infertility ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And she was told... Well, you didn't adopt, so that's really if you can't have kids, you need to adopt.
Oh wow!
So a woman telling a woman. So I think it's kind of not. I don't want it even to become a gender thing, like it's male against female. I think that we all have to be intentional about learning how has God gifted each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was such a big turning point in my life to go, wow, how has He gifted me?
Mm-hmm.
What am I to do here? Instead of we join together and marriage is it, I think in the church we need to do a better job of helping people understand that, first of all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Going back to what you said about identity, I think you're absolutely right that, again, it goes back to that party. You know, what do people ask my husband? It's what you do.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for me it was, are you, you know, how many kids do you have? And
did he wave and go, I have some too?
At that point, we didn't have any.
Yeah, that's right.
So then I tell him about our infertility?
Right.
Do I tell him I'm a writer?
Just,
you know,
it becomes awkward immediately.
It's a conversation.
Yeah. It's a killer.
Yeah.
But I co-teach a course in sexual ethics here, and one of the assignments we give students is to look at masculinity/femininity curriculum that churches are doing. And one of their evaluations is constantly... People are defining femininity for women going straight to the marriage text, right? And so we're not laying out what is a woman's identity. We're laying out what is a wife's identity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going back to Genesis, and, you know, sometimes reading the church fathers can mess you up a little bit on this, right? Because some of them thought that women weren't made in the image of God, but that they were made in the secondary image if they're married. And so we need to begin by teaching women, you are made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
You are made as a co-ruler, a co-creator, a co-companion.
It's just in Genesis 1 at the start.
Exactly.
Yes.
And a lot of us are warning about the dangers of feminism, warning about, you know, devaluing motherhood, but, you know, what we're against, but we're not actually giving a foundation of who actually are you.
Mm-hmm.
And a goal for a woman is not to be married, it's not to have kids, it's to be Christ-like, it's to have the fruit of the Spirit, and it might manifest itself in marriage, but it also might manifest itself in the marketplace, or it might do both. And so you just sort of need to broaden our idea that we've just devalued motherhood, and we have done that, but there's also a lot of other things we've devalued that we need to kind of relook at.
And you put that next to the church's kind of awkwardness also with the whole idea of singleness.
Right.
And that combination.
It's the same root. Really.
It is, yeah. And so you're locked in. And of course, the interesting thing about Genesis 1 is that, you know, that text is, I think, clear that men and women are both made in the image of God. In fact, the whole structure of the creation story, I like to tell people just to have some fun, that the creation story, actually the high point is when the woman's created, you know, because it finishes the sequence.
Codes,
it completes the sequence, and there's something missing until she's brought onto the stage. And there are other elements of the way that works too. The whole role that the woman is said to have as being a helper, which we tend to interpret in a very soft kind of
hamburger
way.
Hamburger helper, plumber's helper.
It is actually a very strong word. It's a word that's used to describe what God does. And so so it's not this kind of, you know, 98-pound weakling look, but it's actually, it really does complete the puzzle. And they were designed to function together as a team that complemented one another with the recognition they needed one another in order to do that. And when you do that, of course, that puts pressure on building towards the family, et cetera. But the point is that that is design is generic. It's not just about families. It's about how God has made the creation and how he's made men and women, and they're supposed to function alongside each other. So there's a huge theological base here that we're talking about.
I saw a piece of research on boards that came out after the whole Wall Street scandal. And the question was posed, okay, these were all male boards that were unethical. What would happen if you had all female boards? Research said just as unethical.
Uh-huh.
The more ethical boards had men and women working together. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it goes back to Genesis. In some mysterious way, it's not just marriage. It's we were made to be partnering together as we're having dominion.
Yeah, what I have, what I find fascinating, and I think I've become more sensitive to this in the last 8-10 years. But we recently did a chapel, as we often do, and I purposely put one of our New Testament faculty members, who's female, on the team. We were discussing the infancy material, and you know, and so you know, there's standard conversations you have about Jesus's birth, and you know, there's the census, and the, you know, what life's like in the first century, and just all kinds of variety of things that you normally go through to try and paint the backdrop. And we're about halfway through this chapel, about 30 minutes, and Terry Moore, who I had asked to do it, spoke up and said, well, let me tell you a little bit about childbirth in the Greco-Roman world. You know, and I'm sitting here going, and the moment she went there, I went, you know, I don't know how many times I've gone through this passage. I don't know how many details of everyday life I've thought about. I have at least thought about, you know, how old was this gal when this was all going on in the context of the culture, which shocks people because she's a very young teenager in all likelihood. And so I'm telling people, you know, she's in the 7th or 8th grade, which blows people away to start off with. But the one thing I had not thought about to probe at all was how childbirth works. And she had done, so she spent about 4 or 5 minutes in this chapel talking about what it was like to be a woman in the ancient world getting ready to bear your first child. And, you know, an angle I would, for lack of a better, I would have been completely, I was completely oblivious.
Yeah.
It was not on my radar. I hadn't thought about it. You know, it wasn't a place I very naturally go, obviously. And so, and I was so grateful that she was there because it added, a whole nother important dimension to the story. And because of how God made her, she had sensitivities that naturally went there that, I'm not going there unless someone taps me on the shoulder and said, hey, you know. And so,
but you asked, what can the church do? What can we tell pastors? Yeah. That's a great example of looking at everyone in your congregation and their gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And what voices are we not hearing?
Mm-hmm.
And where can we plug in some of these infertility patients who could do great work on a missions board or great work on a, you know, whatever, instead of just assuming there are certain roles that those women can fill, or men too. I mean, this is a crisis for men. It's just more of a quieter crisis.
I think that's true. It's like I say, it's an area that impacts people, but I think one of the reasons, in fact, it's one of the rationales for doing the podcast is that unless you have gone through it or have been very close to someone who's gone through it, you don't know what it is to go through it.
No.
I mean, it's just, to make people aware of this being often a significant battle in people's lives in terms of how they see themselves and what they're about is an important thing to realize. Okay, well, I want to turn our attention a little bit. And we'll come back to this because I think on the other side there's still more to say. But I'd like to dive into kind of the story. And this is going to be a hard conversation in some ways because I'm going to ask kind of to walk us through the the process of what this is like to go through. And Julie, we probably have time just for your story on the first half, and then on the other end of the break, we'll pick up Sandy's story. So let's talk about. So you came from this huge family, right? And you were expecting this to happen, and you had timed it. Okay, we've got our time for us. You know, yes. It sounds like a title of a soap opera.
Us. Yeah, I think it's
for us.
There's a song. Yes, I'll remember the movie in a minute.
That's right. Yeah.
Love story.
Romeo and Juliet. Yeah,
exactly
time for
right.
Us.
So yes. Okay, yes. And you say, okay, our time's up, and then you dive in, and what I'm hearing, what I've already heard that grabs my attention immediately is that there are multiple attempts and multiple disappointments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's, I'm trying to think of how to succinctly describe.
Yeah.
Because I didn't even realize I was infertile.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think part of the problem is even recognizing mm-hmm. whatever age you are, that's where you are.
Yeah.
And so, again, I started researching, you know, the whole Google
yeah.
it and talking to friends and... Mm-hmm. And then I started seeing things about age, and
uh-huh.
I had never paid attention. Nobody told me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you hear, well, it's harder, but you don't really hear it.
Right, right.
I'm very passionate now about young women understanding and women who are in their early 30s
uh-huh.
and getting married.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty real with them
uh-huh.
about what they should do and not do, and don't listen to doctors telling you to be patient and wait.
Right, right.
Here's some basic things. Please do this. Because if I knew then what I know now, I would have done it totally different. I mean, and you
interesting.
Might be the same way. But, you know, I had a friend who said to me, she had a friend who said, I don't understand. This has taken over your life.
Mm-hmm.
She said, of course it has. I get up in the morning and I have to take my temperature before I get out of bed. And mm-hmm. I have to write it on my little chart. And then I get up and I have to go in the bathroom and I have to give myself a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to go in and make my breakfast. And it's a specific breakfast. I have to be very careful. And so it's just like this whole daily.
There's a regimen attached.
Yeah. There is. Yeah. And when you're in the middle of it and when you recognize it and you start going to doctors and it's very confusing. And there's not someone that's kind of, I want to maybe be that voice of, here are just some basic things to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have doctors saying, oh, you need to do this test. The financial, none of ours was covered by insurance.
Oh, wow.
And so then you have that whole mm-hmm. piece of it, the emotional, the physical, and then depending on what level you're in and what treatments and what surgeries and all of that, then you have hormonal things going on. And a lot of times, people don't even know you're in the midst of it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to discover it.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything that you go through is so embarrassing and humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
The tests for the men, the tests for the women, awful,
mm-hmm.
humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
I was so naive. I have no pride left mm-hmm. for things like that because you just get used to it. But you have to discover all of these things, and you have to kind of do it on your own and with your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important for a medical team. And that's why I'm passionate about the church needs to talk about it more so that people feel that people get isolated. We live in little silos in the midst of this pain.
Mm-hmm. And Sandy, we've heard at least a piece of Julie's story. What about yours?
Yeah, it probably wouldn't hurt to back up and define infertility.
Okay.
So it's defined as trying for a year without protected intercourse,
okay.
without success, but it also includes pregnancy loss, the inability to carry to term.
Okay.
And it affects about, the studies vary, but between about 12%, mm-hmm. 12% of couples who are in their childbearing years.
Okay.
So, you know, you look at 10 couples and at least
right.
one of them is going through it.
And after,
on every row of your church,
yeah,
there's probably like somebody, one person.
Yeah. And after 35,
they narrow that down to six months. Yeah,
uh-huh.
not a year of trauma. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So pretty much there's a big
And I take it the curve in some ways also goes up because
when
the longer
aging,
you wait, the higher the percentage goes.
Yeah. Okay. And about a huge percentage of people who seek medical treatment go on to conceive. It's much lower for couples who don't. And one of the first ethical struggles is you read those stories about women in the Bible who conceived.
Right.
You know, God closed their womb, then they opened them. So for Christians, often there's an issue. I talked to somebody this week. The initial question is it okay to even go to the doctor for this?
Yeah.
Or am I taking things into my own hands?
Yeah.
And so my usual answer to that is, would you go to the doctor if you had cancer?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, there are medical, 90% of the time, there's a findable medical reason.
Yeah, just to find out.
Just to find out.
Yeah.
And just to know. Because you should know that anyway. I mean, if there's something causing it, you might need to know that, you know, there might be a thyroid problem you need to know about, whatever. Anyway, we had to work through some of that, too. And all the way up through, is it okay to do in vitro? And when does life begin? And how do you manage your treatment? So that's sort of the ethical journey that we were on. You know, and I mentioned sort of the identity journey of what does it mean to be a woman, and do I have a life, and is it okay to build a career, and if I start taking classes to build a career, does that mean I'm devaluing motherhood? All of those questions. But in terms of the actual medical experience, I was pretty chill for the first couple of years, and it was my doctor who said, you know, you've actually exceeded the definition. I said, I'm not infertile, I'm just having trouble getting pregnant. And what's the difference? But at the time, to me, there was a big difference. Like, I wasn't going to obsess like those women do, right? And so so we started in on treatment. And, you know, it's love by the calendar, which is a total violation of your privacy. And the statistics show it really does wreck your love life because you're thinking about this thing. And you're constantly trying to decide, who do I tell what? And I remember going back to work one day after being at the doctor, and somebody said, so what did the doctor do to you today? I said, could you rephrase that? How you doing today? It's just so awkward and awful. And then there's also the marital crisis is typically the husbands experience everything the wives do, but later. And especially with the internet now, we can find support groups. We're talking about infertility. We're talking about adoption sooner than our husbands are typically. So you can find yourselves on unparalleled journeys in terms of how much you've worked through it. Since it's during your childbearing years.
What you're telling me is guys are emotionally a little behind the women.
Actually, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is they're informationally behind.
Okay.
So they, because they're not.
They process it slower.
So they haven't even thought about adoption yet. But you're already talking to your friends in the support group who are thinking about it.
Interesting.
So you might get ahead of each, you know, wives typically get ahead of their husbands. The other thing that happens is that wives who are maybe more global feel like they need to process it all the time because it's a huge grief.
Right.
And the husbands can just, their eyes glaze over going, I want my wife back.
Yeah.
So typically people say the greatest loss for her is the inability to have a child. And the greatest loss for him is the loss of his happy wife. So he'll do anything to get her back. He'll sacrifice, but he'll say things like, I'm willing to not have children if that's what it takes, which she can hear as, see, I knew you weren't committed.
Yeah.
Right? And so you're trying to love, but you're just missing it. Completely normal.
Yeah.
But if you don't know that, you can really, couples might think I married the wrong person, or, you know, this is a horrible crisis. The other thing that happens is that it happens typically in the younger or earlier years of your marriage. And for most couples, it's the first grief they've been through together. And the first time they really find themselves on different pages. And so it can be very isolating as well. This person I was close to, and you know, we were always on the same page about, we are not on the same page about this. Emotionally, spiritually, we're just at different places. So that adds to the grief, in addition to not being able to have a child, is that relational angst of, I'm going through this and I'm kind of going through it alone, even if he's super supportive. So that's where I encourage churches to have support groups, not therapist-led support groups, just groups where people can get together and know that typically the wives will get together more often than the husbands.
Interesting. So we really are pointing out some layers to this. I mean, there's the there's an identity layer, there's a medical regimen layer, there's the relational layer of what this means for your marriage. And we've touched on the relations that are happening within the marriage, but it also produces, and we've suggested this already, some interesting pressures with regard to how you're relating to your friends. Another thing that I think it might be interesting to explore a little bit is, I imagine this gets tricky for your friends who are having children or raising
survivor
children.
Survivor guilt.
That's
yes.
right. Okay.
Absolutely.
And so their life is flowing along the path of the expectations. That's where we started that you had. And it's you know, traveling down that highway pretty nicely. And lo and behold, you know, here you are back at the gas station.
Yeah.
You know?
So if I don't go to a baby shower, right. it might be because I don't want to take the focus off the person being honored.
Right.
And people might think I'm feeling sorry for myself.
Right, right.
I mean, constantly those social issues of, I don't want to go to a shower and hear your time is coming.
Right,
either.
Right,
I just
right.
don't want it to be about me.
Right, right.
Or their child may be a grief trigger to
yeah,
me.
Which right? raises a whole nother thing that's actually probably its own complete podcast, which is how often people around people in a situation will try and communicate something that's actually said out of empathy and out of mm-hmm. concern and compassion, but it actually lands as a thud.
Yeah. And, there are lots of those.
You know, yeah. and so it totally fails to accomplish what it's seeking to accomplish just because the distance between what the person is experiencing and what their friend thinks they need is so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then it falls on the grieving person to try to instruct and you just
and make them feel
the
better.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
yeah.
So,
yeah.
well, we can see there are many dimensions to this. Anything in this relational area that we've kind of failed to mention? I have one other major topic that I kind of know I want to go through.
Just real quick, people need to be willing to sit with people in that really awkward place.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay yeah. to not have an answer. It's okay. It's much better to just sit and be present than say
weep with those who weep.
Don't pull out your Bible and start quoting scripture at uh-huh. the inappropriate time. There's a time for that, but
right.
but I had that happen when I was raw and uh-huh. I just got mad at God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there are different ways. I actually am really passionate. I do workshops on equipping communities mm-hmm. how to walk well with people because I feel like nobody means to inflict harm and pain. And,
right, exactly.
And it's the people closest to us that really are the ones who
often
do that.
Do it, yeah. yeah.
Without
yeah.
meaning to.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it can be well-intentioned, yeah. but it ends
yes.
up landing in the exact
yes.
opposite space. And so, well, here's another dimension of this that you all have already alluded to, and I think I'm going to take a shot at this. It may end up being the most painful part of the journey, and that is what we might call the initial seeming success that doesn't work out. So the process of miscarriage and that reversal of emotion. I think you've both mentioned that you both went through this. So Julia, I'll let you start. It's been the most painful part of the trip?
Yes. Yes. In fact, my third pregnancy lasted till the end of the first trimester. And so that everybody says when you can get there. And I was doing shots twice a day and mm-hmm. doing all kinds of things and really working hard to make this work. And mm-hmm. we knew it was our last shot based on my age and the amount of time we'd put into it and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And it was really painful because we went in, we'd seen the heartbeat. We went in expecting to hear the heartbeat, and we had a less than sensitive sonographer who basically did the sonogram and then immediately just started packing everything up and said, you need to go to the doctor's office and sit and wait. And we're like, whoa, well, what? We want to hear the heartbeat. She goes, there's no heartbeat. It's no longer a vital pregnancy.
Wow.
And we just were devastated because it was just so
that's the end of the road for
and
you.
And that's yeah. another yes yeah. and that's another thing, you know, the medical personnel, they can't cry with everybody and they can't, but there's a fine line.
Yeah.
And so that was the biggest devastation of that was I am not going to be a mom.
Yeah, sure.
And what does that look like in my life?
Yeah.
What do I do now? Who am I?
Yeah.
And one of the biggest questions that I think people ask when they're in the middle of it, and then in my case, when they realize they're going to be childless,
uh-huh.
Am I not blessed by God?
Yeah. So
because back to that Old Testament,
right.
it's and then God blessed them and opened their womb, and people try to carry that forward to
right.
our New Testament living.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the hill becomes a wall, and it's not going to get scaled.
Yes, correct. And it's a lifetime.
Right,
we were
right.
just discussing now, we're now going through seasons of friends who have, they're starting to have, if they had kids young and their kids are having kids young, they're grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a whole new layer of pain
uh-huh.
of, oh,
yeah.
Oh, I don't get that either.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a lifelong, it's just one of those thorns in the flesh
mm-hmm.
for life that you have to work through and make your peace with God and then embrace
mm-hmm.
your purpose
and it's different in your situation than it is for some. I've had a daughter who's had a miscarriage, and you know, I know what that experience can be like. I've had close friends who've had miscarriages, but there's always the expectation on the other end that if we continue, we'll again, get to have a child. And so in this context, it adds to the uncertainty and adds to the pain in two ways: the loss, but then the really more nagging question. I manage it ups the ante to a certain extent.
For me, I was a younger patient, when we were getting close to the end of treatment, thinking this isn't working, and then I got pregnant. Mm. So then for us, it was like that proverbial carrot of do you stop now?
Yeah.
You know, so seven pregnancy losses later, we're like, yeah, we stop now.
Uh-huh.
But it kept us in the game for years.
Yeah.
Thinking, well, gosh, if I got pregnant, then, you know, this has got to work. And, you know, it turned out to be an immune system problem, so my body attacked the embryo. But we didn't know that at the time.
Right.
We didn't know what was causing it. Huh. And so, thinking we're almost done at 3 years, and then that extending into 7 years because I kept conceiving.
Mm. Wow. So, so how do you get on the other end of that? I mean, or do you?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, and after I interviewed several women about their, who've now had years of living and being childless, and when I say childless, I want to clarify that. Mm-hmm. It is not less than as a person.
Mm-hmm.
It is that I'm missing the child.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of women who choose to not have children. They call themselves child-free.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of push back against the less.
Uh-huh.
They don't want to be thought of as a less than.
Right.
And that's not what I mean when I say I'm childless.
Uh-huh.
I'm meaning I will never fill that little spot. I mean, that's just what I'm going to live
right.
in. But I think really, truly, learning your identity, learning who God created you to be, aside from any other role, just being in Christ, and then having community, finding supportive community around you, finding ways to serve. We need to invite people in. We need to recognize women's giftedness.
Meaningful work.
And say, come in and work alongside us, not just in the nursery.
Right.
And especially not in the nursery if you can't have children. Right. But I think there it is. It is, and it's a different process. It is a lengthy grieving process for, and with any grief, it's different for everyone.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. You can't have an expectation of people to be over.
Mm-hmm.
And even those women who have kids after a miscarriage,
some of them,
they still are going to grieve that miscarriage.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And so I guess, you know, one of the things that I guess comes up sometimes is to say, well, is there? It's a void, at least for some people. And so, how do you fill it? I mean, you know, our nieces and nephews, gifts, and that kind of thing.
Change Mother's Day to Mothering Day.
Yeah.
Honor everybody who's mentoring.
Yeah.
Mentoring's
a big one.
Uh-huh.
You know, Mother's Day is a Hallmark holiday. The church doesn't have to do Hallmark. We can make our own. And mothering, you know, when you look at Scripture, that's what we're made to do. We're supposed to be reproducing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so to honor everyone who's doing that is also something that is a comfort.
Yeah, I think this is an underestimated feature of the conversation, because I know, at least in our family, in certain situations, the aunts and the uncles are able to do things with kids that mothers and dads can't.
Yes,
absolutely.
And so
they're always cooler.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. We are.
and so that can be a very important role. It's not the same thing as having your own, but it is. But it is an extended family. I mean, and it needs to be viewed that way.
The body of Christ, where we ended up adopting somebody who didn't have parents.
Mm-hmm.
We were the parents of the groom on his wedding day.
Mm-hmm.
So in the body of Christ, the kids without parents have parents, and parents without children have children. I also want to say that something that was profoundly helpful for me was learning to pray the Lament Psalms.
Mm.
And, you know, in America, we're in, right, out, right, up, right, down, right, happy all the time. And, you know, but that's the most common form of prayer, mm-hmm. as you know, in the Psalms is a lament. And I, in my early training as a Christian, was taught you don't ask God questions, but the Psalms are full of questions.
Right.
I was taught that you don't, you know, express outrage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had to learn the difference between why and why, uh-huh. right?
Right.
But that I have permission to do that, that God actually gives me guides. Hey, you're not actually ranting loudly enough. Let me give you some guides, you know? It was very freeing.
There have been a few people who've gone down this road before.
Exactly. Yeah. But also the recognition as I matured, everybody has unfulfilled longings. Mm-hmm. Everybody does.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so to grieve them and to recognize them, but to also recognize my own mother who had five children, always wanted to go back to college. Mm. I had ended up adopting one child and got a PhD. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I'm living out her dream. And mm-hmm. in some ways, she lived out mine. And uh-huh. so just the recognition that pain is pain is pain.
Mm-hmm.
We're not running the suffering Olympics. Mm-hmm. We can empathize with each other, even if you're a mother whose child just spit up on you for the 14th time and you're wearing a silk blouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can empathize with that mother instead of saying, well, it must be nice because you could have kids. Recognizing the maturity says everybody has stuff.
Yeah.
And to weep with those who weep, not to one-up them, not to quote Bible to them, not to tell them to, you know, cheer up.
So we've gone through, we've gone through these various levels. We've talked about identity. We've talked about the regimen. We've talked about the relational. We've talked about the pain of the losses. And there's one other element that I think needs to be brought up, and that is the financial impact of what we're talking about, which obviously ends up impacting everything that's going on. And I imagine also impacts the dynamics between the couple. You've already talked about the dynamics just relationally, but
money comes into that
big time, because it ends up people have got to decide the costs, and this is not to pursue this and try and get over it can be very expensive, right?
Absolutely.
Is.
Yes, I ended up, I think I went to four specialists and had I don't know how many surgeries and, you know, just trying to do things that might help things and the medications and the testing and the blood work, and it all adds up. And mm-hmm. I do know people who are going through now, and in the last few years, insurance has really changed mm-hmm. a little as far as what's covered, but it still is a pretty big. And I think,
because you said you weren't initially covered for some of what you were doing.
We weren't covered for any of it.
It's considered elective.
And so we ended up, and we never did IVF.
Mm-hmm. In vitro.
We did all the way up to.
Mm-hmm.
And so in vitro, I think now is at about $10,000 a try.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say, I know a lot of people who've had to try that two and three and more times.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very costly, and that adds a whole, you know, they say that,
right.
you know, financial is the biggest fight couples have, and so that puts that whole emphasis on the money, which is sad, mm-hmm. but it does, because mm-hmm. you can, and what I think the emotional and the financial mm-hmm. get caught up,
mm-hmm.
because earlier when you said, I'm not going to be one of those women, and I laughed, because you find yourself, I had a good close person who said, draw your line in the sand early.
Mm-hmm.
You two sit together and decide, where are you drawing your financial line in the sand? Because once you get caught up in the emotions of it and the tests and the loss, you're going to want to just put money and money, money, and borrow money. And she said, that will harm your marriage. And that was one of the best pieces of advice I got.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree? I mean,
well, yes,
would you
no,
agree with that?
In our situation where we were ready to quit, and then there's a miscarriage.
Yes.
We had to reevaluate that money question of, gosh, have we almost got it fixed? Are we almost there?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just complicated.
It is.
But you're right. A real source of tension can be, I'm willing to go this far mm-hmm. and pay this much. This is my whole life. This is, you know, a big part of my identity. And, you know, over here you can be going, I'm not willing to pay that much because, you know, that's going to destroy our finances.
Mm-hmm.
And so one other area where you're just not really on the same page and having to work through.
I just thought of another question. We're running short on time, so we're going to have to handle this one quickly. But what happens, I'll ask it this way. How does the blame game work? Okay, you know what I'm asking?
Yep.
You know, where's the problem?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
how does that work in all this?
The best thing probably my husband ever said to me was, I didn't marry you for your ability to have children. And this is our problem, and I'm going to the doctor with you, and this is not your problem. That was such a healing thing for him to say.
Yeah.
I know, too. My husband was very supportive in that manner as well. I also know that in my own head, I was constantly, because I'm the one that had the problems. So I had this constant little voice saying, well, you know, you've got this wrong and this wrong, and now you found out about this. And so it's really kind of your fault.
What about the feeling of letdown that that comes with that? In other words, that if you're the one who's discovered to have the problem, the feeling is, I've just robbed someone that I love.
Exactly.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. I said to my husband, like, you should find somebody who can give you children. He's like, that's nuts.
Yeah.
But still, I did.
That's actually probably theologically accurate.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I still think that.
Yeah.
I still, as we get Christmas cards, that people have our age have 17 people in the picture because they got their four kids and their kids are starting to get married and have kids. And you know, I'm looking at that thinking, I have robbed him of that. And that's where I'm really thankful I married somebody who believes in the sovereignty of God.
Well, we're really tight for time. I'm going to try to throw out one question, but it's got to be answered fairly crisply, and it's this. You know, you've heard what we've said. What one other piece of advice would you give to the church in general as they think about this area? What is there anything that we haven't covered or missed that we should say, or what can be done? That's a wide open
question. Don't leave out the husbands in a miscarriage.
Okay.
And infertility as well. Male infertility is devastating on the men. But it's devastating for them to watch their wives hurt too.
Invite couples to be involved in areas. Think out of the box. Invite them to mentor other kids. Invite them to be part of families, and offer grace when they may.
So you're talking about taking the couple that's gone through this and make sure that they are
engaged
in the family and the church.
Okay. Well, this has been a fascinating journey. I have to say, and honestly, when I got up this morning, we were thinking about the podcast. I was sitting here going, well, this is something I know next to nothing about, but I know I should know far more about it than I do. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to come in and talk us through your story and the advice that you have. My hope would be that pastors who listen to this in particular, and people who minister to women directly as well, and pastors of men for that matter, that they all would take this seriously, because I think this does produce a terrific amount of pain and potential tension in a marriage, and knowing something about it is actually a pretty important pastoral quality, and the more sensitive the church can be, the better off. So thank you all for coming in.
Thank you for having the conversation about it.
Glad to do it. And we hope that you've enjoyed your time here with us at the table. We hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.